Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Not long after we started the show about 6 months ago, I know it's just been 6 months, time flies, two of our first guests were local social media, they don't want me to call it experts because it's a kiss of death, but anyways, they've now trained some of the best and brightest in Ohio and beyond, and how to use Twitter, how to maximize Facebook, how to tap the internet for all manner of social media tools for business, for politics, for this and for that, for journalism especially, and I've learned a thing or two since then, and I wanted to show off for them. So we invited them back. Deborah Jasper, she's director of the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Journalism at Ohio State University. She teaches at the John Glenn School of Public Affairs and leads digital media creator camps. She's a many times over award-winning journalist, former State House Bureau Chief for the Cincinnati Inquirer, and she's with us today, fresh from the South by Southwest Conference in Austin. Welcome, Deb.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And Betsy Hubbard is manager of the Kiplinger Program. Is that right, Betsy?
That's
I want to make sure I got your title
associate
right.
Associate Director, actually.
Associate Director. Okay. I can't see me. And she teaches at the John Glenn School. Her background is in program management and philanthropy. She works with her Kiplinger colleagues to provide analysis software for crowdsourcing projects and developing tools for journalists to engage the public and so much more. I could go on and on about you guys, both of you, but I just have to stop it there and get to the show. Welcome, Betsy.
Thanks so much. Glad to be here.
Before we get started, I want to officially invite my listeners to follow me on Twitter at Ann Fisher WOSU. We thought how long and hard about that.
Yay.
So follow me. Ann Fisher, WOSU. And on Facebook at All Sides with Ann Fisher, we have a fan page now, and it's a lot nicer because it's interactive, and I can hear back from the members of the fan page, All Sides with Ann Fisher. It includes the added bonus of regular updates on the schedules for All Sides with Ann Fisher. So, and if you want to find all of that, you can find links at WOSU.org/allsides. So, what are the latest stats on social media? Who uses it now? Has it changed much in 6 months?
I tell you what, it changes every time we do a presentation, which is sometimes every week. We're changing the stats, so it's growing exponentially. In Facebook alone, there are over 400 million people. If it was a country, it would be the third largest country in the world, right behind China and India. So a lot of people are engaging in Facebook. Twitter is the fastest growing social network, 100 million users now. It's grown 500% in just the last year. And YouTube, we are watching about 28 billion videos a month. Yes, that's with a B. So we're really watching a lot of videos just on YouTube, Hulu, CNN videos, you know, that sort of thing. So a lot of us are definitely engaging in this space.
Do we know, have any kind of sense about on a state-by-state basis? That was a question somebody had for me. If there was any sense about, you know, are there some states that do social media more than others?
I haven't seen stats on that, have you? But yeah, that's a great question. It'd be fun to see if more people are tweeting in California than in Kentucky, for example.
It's really interesting. When I went to Creator Camp last fall to see when you showed us how when an issue popped up, I can't even remember what it was. Yeah. It might have been the election of Barack Obama.
Sure.
And they showed the Twitter activity around the world and how as people woke up that morning, how it was being tweeted around the world.
Yes, you can definitely. I mean, it is amazing. They did a data visualization not long ago where it showed just 11,000 tweets of the people who were tweeting out the word good morning. So all around the world. Twitter's in, do you know how many languages, Betsy? It's
well, they're saying now that 50% of the tweets are
Non-English?
Aren't in English.
I can vouch for that. There's a lot of well, that sounds interesting that I get there.
That's right.
And Facebook is now in more than 70 languages.
Yeah.
And actually, Tuesday, we're working with Ukraine. We're doing training for the Council of Ministers and the Ukrainian government. So, you know, people all over the world are really getting engaged in these spaces. So we're going to be doing a webinar for them on Tuesday. So it's interesting who's calling us to say, hey, let's talk social media.
Yeah, it is. It's amazing how unifying it is. I was going to ask you about that hyper-distracted audience that you hear so much about, and I think I did an ellipses at the end of that because I started reading or watching YouTube and a three-year-old explaining the story of Star Wars on YouTube this morning, and I couldn't turn it off. I was so addicted. And I thought, why am I doing this? Oh, that's right. I'm right. I'm working on a show about social media today. Hyper-distracted.
It's funny that you say. We spend about 10 hours every month on average just watching YouTube videos. And a lot of, you know what happens? You watch a video and then it recommends another video and you wake up and it's midnight and you look around and you've been watching videos for a long time. But yeah, one of the sessions that we do training in is really called capturing an inattentive audience, breaking through the noise, how to capture a hyper-distracted audience. And what we found is increasingly, you know, our students, for example, have their laptops up. The information's not just up front. It's at their desks. You think about it, pilots aren't even landing the plane where they're supposed to because they admit that they were on their laptops. We can't get people to stop texting while they're driving. So increasingly, we say it's a game on world. It is very hard to get people's attention these days, and you have to be incredibly creative and informal and engaging to get people to listen.
How do you teach somebody that, Betsy?
Well, what makes it easier is that we all recognize it. I mean, when we talk to people, we say, do you have trouble getting people to read to the end of the email? And we all know that. I mean, we've often had people call us and say, what time is that event? And we say, that was in the second paragraph. Did you read the second paragraph? You know, so people recognize this, and all of us. It's useful to step back, though, and just start to think about what is it that helps break through this. Sometimes I think today it is so easy to publish, it means that people just publish too easily. They really don't take the time to think about crafting what it is that they want to say. And so we work a lot in helping people recognize what is a good story. I mean, if you're going to share something, whether it's in a blog or a video, it really takes an investment of time, and you have to put the thinking in first, because if the thinking is not sound, it is really not, you have no hope of trying to capture people's attention. But we talk about the power of emotion in a story. We talk about having a story, a narrative, making it concrete so people can understand it. So there's a lot of strategies to think about when you're trying to publish, whether it is video or text, you know, blog or...
Yeah, we teach this graduate level course in the John Glenn School, and we get students who come to us and they've just written a 30-page thesis, and we say, okay, how do you tweet out about it? And they're looking at us like, what? You know, now I have to try to get you to read my thesis, and I have 140 characters in a tweet. You know, I have to post short. But what we say is, you know, brevity, you need to be short, but you need to be clear. And casual writing doesn't mean careless writing. You really do have to think about how you get your message out, and you have to think about how to get it out in a much shorter way. I was the ultimate long-form narrative writer when I was a journalist. I wrote, you know, hundreds of inches, and I love to tell long stories. And today I realize, no, you have to chunk that out. You have to break it up. You have to give it to people more visually. Even PowerPoint presentations have radically changed. We have more than 100 slides for just an hour presentation because they move very fast. They're very visual. You can't put a lot of text up there. You know, it has to be, you have to give people information in the way that they can take it in today.
You know, in journalism now more than ever, you have to know what your lead is and you have to know what the nut graph is.
You really
do. What's the story about?
You really do. And you have to say, okay, and if you let us give you visuals because we can do that on our website today. And let us tell you the story in a lot of different ways. You can do data visualizations, which are really animated graphics, which can tell powerful stories. So you do have to think about brand new approaches. And you really see that with the back channel today. We were going to talk a little bit about, you know, what we just saw at South by Southwest. And everybody was, this is a big social media conference. It's in Austin, Texas. 15,000 people were there just for the social media aspects of the conference, the interactive aspects.
That's a much bigger part of it now, it sounds
huge.
Like.
It was huge. It was a 40% increase in attendance over last year. So you can see lots of people are engaging in this. There are businesses there. There are, you know, ad agencies there. And everybody's waiting on the speaker, who's going to be Evan Williams, who's one of the founders of Twitter.
I follow,
you know,
Ev.
Yes. People were streaming into this conference to hear him speak, and then he comes out and he has a few announcements, but pretty soon the interview's not going very well. The interviewer who's
even
a blogger
Evan...
Well, he had an interviewer who's a blogger from Harvard, and he wasn't asking very, you know, pinpoint questions. The audience start tweeting out. So the back channel is really the, you know, the front channel is the people who are up front speaking. The back channel is the audience, and they're talking to each other on Twitter, and they're saying things like, the guy behind me is snoring, you know, and pretty soon people actually started leaving. So about half, some estimates as high as 80%, but I was there. I walked in as people were leaving, and because I had been in the overflow room, which emptied out pretty quick. So I went into the main room, and you realize, wow, people are streaming out. And it's a great example of today, you just don't have a captive audience. And if you're not engaging, they'll either leave or they'll what you call back channel you. They call it tweckling. You know, they'll take you out
which
on Twitter.
Sends, it chills up my spine.
Yeah.
I mean, I've never done a public speaking thing since then with the same feeling.
We do a lot of public speaking, and there are ways that you can manage this. You can start to say, hey, I'm going to take questions on Twitter. You can, if you're watching Twitter as you're speaking, you can see, oh, you know, this isn't going well, or this is going really well. But we also say you really can prepare. you can do a lot more advanced preparation, because you can't just come in at the last minute and think, now who am I speaking to? Because audiences today just don't have patience for that. And what Ev Williams did that was so smart is afterwards he tweeted out and said, hey, the back channel seems unhappy. I didn't get enough tough questions. Go ahead and ask me the questions you want to ask. I'll take 10. Go. Very smart. So he started asking questions on Twitter afterwards.
It's funny because millions follow him on Twitter, but he couldn't hold an audience of a couple thousand, you know, in Austin last week.
Yeah, truly, he's a very low-key guy. Mm-hmm. I was somewhat surprised. You know, he's low-key, he's thoughtful. And what's so interesting is when you read the tweets, most people who are tweeting out made it very clear. They'd use a hashtag, they'd sign it, you know, we love you, Ev, and be complaining about the moderator. So they weren't directing, you know, a lot of their vitriol towards him. It was the moderator. They thought he didn't ask very hard-hitting questions. And they also, there were high expectations around this event because there were rumors that Twitter was going to come out and announce, mm-hmm. you know, their new revenue plan and ad platforms
Twitter, right.
and
mm-hmm.
all of that. So the audience was really keyed up to get a certain kind of information. And when it became obvious that they weren't going to talk about that, they just totally lost the audience.
And so, that's what I saw on Twitter, a lot of people Twittering about.
What I think this is a great example of, though, is, you know, we'll work with CEOs sometimes and they'll say, well, I'm not going to get on Twitter. You know, I'll just solve that. And we say, well, you know, the online world and the offline world has merged so much that people's expectations have changed, and that affects you whether you're in these spaces or not. So even if you're not on Twitter, if you give a talk or if you try to, you know, get your boss's attention or if you send out emails or if you write memos, I mean, really just about anything you do today is influenced by people's changing expectations of the web. We see that a lot. You know, these days we're on Facebook. We get very quick responses. Hey, should I shop at the store? Is this a good restaurant? You know, people will tweet or will post back and say, love that restaurant or I hate that restaurant. So we're used to getting these very quick responses, and our expectations have changed for how quickly people are going to talk back to us. You know, how quickly we can reach out and get opinions.
And how quickly things can turn on you if you've done something
yes.
stupid out in the business or political world. You know, Betsy, now you have Twitter on right now.
Yeah.
If people wanted to send you a question for us, what would we direct them?
Well, you could either do it to @AnnFisher, WOSU, your Twitter account, or you can send it to us, either @BetsyHubbard or @DeborahJasper, and we'll be able to pick it up and take a look.
Okay, let's see if we can get some questions via Twitter.
Or you can use the old-fashioned telephone.
Or you can do that, too. Gosh, I almost forgot. 614-292-8513. Or you can email us, too. It's kind of like, what is it, Eastmail? Or I don't know. At allsides at WOSU.org. Take a quick break. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
You're listening to WOSU 820 NPR News. At 1 o'clock on point, we'll be here. Top Pentagon brass complain about the Israeli-Palestinian impasse and complain that it's undermining American interests. On Point looks at the U.S.-Israel moment of crisis. That discussion at 1 o'clock on Point, right here on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from SAFI, Specialized Alternatives for Families and Youth, envisioning the day when every child is part of a loving family and is able to reach his or her greatest potential. Information is online at safy.org.
52 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 65. Clear skies tonight, a low of 38 degrees. More sunshine for Friday, a high of 65 degrees, and more sunshine for Saturday as well. All Sides with Ann Fisher continues on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Hi, everyone. I'm Mark. I've got 700 friends on Facebook. I've got one special friend. We've been chatting for over a month and a half now. It's just the past few weeks she hasn't been replying as often as she did. And I poked her earlier in the week, and so far she hasn't poked back.
Okay. Well done, Mark. Admitting you have a problem is such an important first step, okay? Great, have a seat. Okay. Matt! stop writing on the wall, please.
Okay. That is a clip from a meeting of the Social Media Addicts Association with members discussing the problems caused by their addiction. And, of course, when he's saying stop writing on the wall, please, in the video that accompanies this humorous skit, a guy is actually over there writing on the wall because they're not allowed to have any of their electronic devices with them in this meeting. So this guy can't stop writing on the wall, the figurative wall, and he goes and writes on the literal wall. So much of social media references do refer to concrete things in our world. You know, it's kind of interesting to make it familiar and comfortable, right?
It's a great strategy because, I mean, these tools are new to most all of us. And so anything you can do to help people get on, it's interesting. Twitter is the fastest growing social network out there, but it's not at all intuitive is what we find. And, you know, that was my own experience. I signed up and then thought, what now? Why is everyone talking about this? So I do think it's a challenge as this moves from the sort of early adopters and the sort of geek-oriented community to the rest of us. I think a challenge for folks who are putting together the social networks are to figure out how do you make it easier for people to join in, because sometimes it's just not that easy.
Let's talk about how social media, by the way, my guest, you just heard Betsy Hubbard. She is Associate Director of the Kiplinger Program at Ohio State University. And my other guest, Deborah Jasper, she's the Director of the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Journalism at OSU. How has social media changed how we do business, really? Because you said some CEOs have decided, well, I'm not going to get on Twitter. I'm not going to Facebook. I'm just, if we don't do it, then it won't hurt us.
Right. We say, you know, all the time, that, and I think businesses are understanding this in new ways, that customer service is the new marketing. Because today, you know, if you have a complaint about a business, then you can complain and maybe 500 of your friends immediately know about it. Or if you're really savvy, you can post United Breaks Guitars. You know, you can do a video like the guy, like Dave Carroll did when his guitar was broken. He posted that video and millions of people saw it in the first few months. So,
you know, we have that. Do we have that right away, Amy? Okay, let's listen to that, because okay. I thought you might bring that up.
Sure.
It's a classic.
United, United, you broke my Taylor guitar. United, United, some big help you are. You broke it, you should fix it. You're liable, just admit it. Should have flown with someone else. You're gone by car. 'Cause United breaks guitars.
Okay, that is a classic example of a guy. You know, we get stuff wrecked in airports and in airlines, wreck stuff all the time. It's nothing new, but he posted a YouTube complaint about it to music.
I love this because I got to tell you, it stays with you forever. Like, you lay in bed at night and sing United Breaks Guitars. It stays in your head. It's not at all what United wants you to think of when you think of United. But what happened is he was flying. They broke his guitar. He tried to get them to fix it. They didn't. And he said, I'm going to write a song about this. And his goal was, he told them, I'll get 100,000 people to view this video in the first year. And instead, more than 5 million people viewed it in the first month. So then they were ready to fix his guitar. But I think for businesses, that's a big eye-opener.
How do you fix the damage,
you know,
done to the business?
Right. Suddenly, you're realizing that a customer is sort of a reporter today. And a customer can, you know, reach a lot of people with a complaint. And that's why we say customer service really is the new marketing plan. Because so many times, well, your friend was on the other day talking about a dishwasher, and she had fanned a particular dishwasher company, Betsy. And
yeah, on Facebook. And her whole purpose of fanning their fan page was that she could complain about her dishwasher. You know, so I'm sure she tried to call
the
1-800 number.
She created a fan page?
No, she went to their fan page.
Okay,
she became a fan so she could start posting up there and start complaining.
Interactive, folks.
Yes.
But Honda found this out the hard way.
Yeah.
You know, with the Cross Tour, they started a fan page and they were inviting everyone, and 4,000 people got on the day they created it, and they were saying, great, we wanted to create buzz, except people got on and said, we hate this car. This is the ugliest car ever. So one of the things that we work with people on is what happens if you build it and they come and they say things you don't like. I mean, that is a big issue increasingly for businesses. And increasingly businesses are realizing that there's always going to be one or two cranky customers, But if there's 400 cranky customers, you really do have to rethink what your strategy is.
You know, there's
is.
A couple way, couple things I want to talk about with that Honda response to that. But first, you know, it is kind of interesting because there's another side to the coin when it comes to United Broke My Guitar. That now his newest song, his name's Dave Carroll, his newest song is called United Broke My Career. In other words, he's made a career out of this now. He became famous. And he has a couple albums, one or two out, I don't know, maybe one. And none of them have anything to do with his guitar or United, but everybody knows who he is.
Oh, I know. His career really took off. And the funny thing was, a few months after that happened, yeah. He was flying, and United lost his luggage. And we always say, you know, wouldn't you say if you were United, look, if this Dave Carroll guy gets on.
Talk about flagging,
you know,
somebody.
Hold his luggage in your lap. Do not lose his luggage. I mean, you would just be like, he's the last guy on earth you want to have a problem with. If I were an airline. And I would have Dave Carroll's name right there saying, do not let anything happen to him. So,
you know, Honda did that. They got not the reaction they expected.
Right, that was the cross tour.
Because they thought it was groovy that they had this page and that it wasn't, aren't we cool? No, not if people don't respond the way you want them to. However, their response back was just as hackneyed as mm-hmm. the original intent. They didn't get it yet.
Right. They did this apology that wasn't very authentic, you know, and they
were
sort of very defensive. And that's another thing that I think businesses, we talk with businesses a lot about is, look, you really have to be casual and authentic today. If you apologize, you have to apologize like you mean it. But interestingly, it hasn't hurt sales of the Cross Tour, it doesn't seem.
I actually liked it.
Yeah, I didn't think it was a bad-looking car. But, you know, that's the other thing that you've got to understand, that a lot of things can happen in the social media space, and it doesn't necessarily mean it's going to hurt your brand. You have to be thoughtful about what goes on there and determine levels of crises.
Another example, though, is the Domino's Pizza example, which it did hurt their brand, and they changed their brand because of this. We've all seen those ads. Betsy, tell us about that.
Oh, boy.
It's fascinating.
It is a fascinating story. I mean, the original story is gross and fascinating in its own way, that people posted a video of doing some sort of terrible things to food and then sending it out, supposedly. And the video went viral immediately, and Domino's was slow to react. I mean, first of all, they weren't monitoring any of what's going on in social media, so they didn't find it immediately. And then when they did find it, they were slow to respond, because undoubtedly they were following the traditional model of, well, let's call in our lawyers and let's get our communication team together and let's see what we might do for this. But they let it go on very slowly. They let it go on for too long. Now, they tried. When they did respond, they posted a YouTube video. But the video was long. Many people complained that the CEO seemed to be reading off of cue cards. You know, it did not seem very authentic. He was complaining about how terrible this was, that it was hurting his brand, and not really saying, isn't it terrible that that this would happen at all. And so the response, at least in the social media world, did not go over very well. Well, Domino's really took this as a learning opportunity, and they have so embraced social media. So they got the concept that social media is not just about broadcasting out. It really is about listening. They took this to heart, and they went through a whole series of focus groups and decided to redesign their pizza and, in a sense, almost try to relaunch their core product. What's unusual about it is that they were so open and transparent about the process. They use that as their new ad campaign. So they have, you know, if you go on their website, and of course they do brief excerpts of this on television commercials, mm-hmm. but you can go and watch the focus groups where people are saying, you know, it tastes like cardboard. Domino's pizza's terrible. I never order it. And you can see their response, their very human responses to it. I mean, it's almost hard to watch the chefs to this focus group response. But they took it to heart. They redesigned their product. They relaunched it. They have some funny videos of the chefs actually going to the door of the people in the focus groups and mm-hmm. saying, we listen to you. Try our new pizza. See what you think. You know, so they brought it into this very human. They got beyond the big corporate name.
They got casual.
They got casual.
But
they got human.
On point.
But on point. And they continue to be really open about it. I mean, if you go to that page, when they launched it, you know, look at the comments. The comments are probably running 50-50, and they are leaving all of them on there. They have a, you know, they're on Twitter. They have a hashtag where people are talking about the new pizza, and a lot of people are panning it, yet they run that on their website. So they've really embraced the notion that people are going to talk about you. You might as well accept it and not try to hide from it.
You can give us a call the old-fashioned way, 614-292-8513, or the other old-fashioned way, allsides at WOSU.org. You can also go to our Facebook page, All Sides with Ann Fisher, and you can comment on that. Our associate producer, Amy Drovitz, says she has it open. We're ready for business. We have some emails. One from Kelly. It's not really old-fashioned, Kelly. I do it all the time, email, but you write, while the technology is impressive, namely for long-distance communications, it seems evident that a glaring side effect is that we simply do not talk to each other anymore. That's a common criticism. It's been going on since the phone was invented, I think. What about that?
You know, I think that it's hard to generalize about that because in many ways what's happening, many people's experience is that being involved in these social networks actually allows them to maintain connections. I mean, what I find is that I am in touch with far more people. And they say, and I think this is a great term, it's about ambient awareness. I mean, it's not that I know every detail that's going on in your life, but I'm keeping up with what's happening to you because I'm reading your Facebook posts or I'm reading what's happening in your life on Twitter. What I find is that when I do then see you, it's a better conversation because if instead of saying, hey, what have you been doing for the last year? I can say, wow, how was that? You know, how do you like the new job and what's happening with it? And you can go immediately to deeper conversations in a way because you have all those sort of formalities out of the way because you are staying in touch. And there's also some studies coming out showing that people who are more connected in the online world are actually more connected in the offline world, too. I mean, if you are connected up, if you are paying attention to what's going on to your neighborhood, you are more likely to actually turn out and go to the neighborhood meetings. So it's not necessarily that it's an either-or proposition. Sometimes being online actually deepens and enriches your offline relationships.
Yeah, there is. I was in a story about South by Southwest that I was reading. One journalist noted that some news sharing sites have taken hits in recent times, like Dig and Read It and Mix. He said they may still survive, however, because one of the things the internet does best is create communities. So it's kind of in the and I have to say, I joined the the AARP club of my graduating class in high school on Facebook and found out, sadly, that one of my classmates had died. And I would never have known that if I hadn't have had that connection. And I wrote back to that and said, this is so great that I was able to find out about this in a timely manner and then respond.
You know, and the other thing I think that's really changing with Facebook, for example, is who's on Facebook. I mean, a lot of people used to think, well, that's what my teenager did or that's what my kids do. And increasingly, of course, nearly a third of the folks on Facebook are mid-career. And the fastest growing numbers on Facebook are over 55. But it's also who's on Facebook. My brother Tommy, who lives down in Kentucky, lives really sort of way out in the country. He has, you know, an eighth grade education. He's never had a computer. And the other day he friended me. And I was really surprised. He would be one of the last people that I would think would, you know, have a laptop. But they got a laptop and they, you know, they're experimenting with Facebook, he and his wife, because his kids are on Facebook. And so now I'm keeping up with my brother Tommy and, you know, in a way that I haven't kept up with him as much in recent years. So I think it's affecting everyone. I mean, lots of people, my stepdad is, you know, he's calling me and telling me about the cool new apps for his cell phone. And some of them I've never heard of. And so, you know, I think there's a lot of areas, the gaps are decreasing now. And a lot of people are using their cell phones to get online and to check their Facebook and check Twitter and that sort of thing.
Why does the demographic tend to be older than, say, Facebook and other applications and other things like that?
Well, I can speculate on that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think part of it is that it got established very quickly for professional networking rather than personal organizing, you know.
Rather than social.
Than social, mm-hmm. Right. And it's a more public network because unless you choose to keep everything private, most people are using Twitter to send out public posts. A lot of teens and other folks are trying to create a social network where they can communicate with people and organize their social life, and they don't necessarily want everything they're doing to be open to the broad public. So it's sort of just a difference in how it's being used and who were the first people to adopt it. It really took off at the South by Southwest conference in 2007, and those are all people who are at that conference for professional reasons.
Yeah, and you know, people often say, well, I don't want to talk about what I had for lunch. And I say, well, that's really not what the network does. I mean, I'm following
some people.
The,
do that.
They do, but it depends on who you follow.
Right.
I'm following some really smart people, and they're telling me what's going on in my industry, my field. You know, you can set it up. It's sort of like watching television. If you watch Gilligan's Island, then that's what you're watching. If you're watching CNN or the Discovery Channel, it's really who do you tune into on Twitter, and that's what you're going to get back. And so I tune into some very smart people who are talking about what's happening, you know, what's the latest happening in the social media field, what's the latest happening in journalism. But journalists, too, are starting to understand that these are amazing tools. We did some training the other day with a group of journalists, and we were talking about how everyone today has a digital footprint. And really helping them understand that there are these deep web searches. And, you know, we were working with some folks the other day, and a guy said, wow, I used Pipel.com, which is P-I-P-L.com. It's a deep web search. And he said, I posted an email to a listserv in 1994, and it came up. Because these searches go, you know, they'll search databases, they'll search more deeply. So you can't really afford to ignore these spaces. When we work with our students, we say, look, Google is the new resume. And a lot of people who are making decisions about whether to hire you, for example, are looking to see what you do in these spaces. And if you have your privacy settings set right, great, but 80% of us don't. And so, you know, things are more public than you think, and you really have to think about that when you start to engage in these
spaces. And if you could just explain that to our 15-year-olds going on 16 about some of the stuff they post on their Facebook isn't always appropriate.
Right.
It may be fun to their friends, but it's there forever.
Right.
And it's not necessarily you want someone to see when you're 25 years old looking for a job.
So true. It is an eye-opener for our students because they go, Betsy was showing one of our students the other day, oh, look, I see you posted a picture of your cat last night. And he's like, oh, wow, you can see a lot that I'm not thinking that you can see. So it is really useful.
Yeah, I try to you know, filter myself, but then it also makes me just act more appropriately in general. You know, you can do stupid things if you don't think anybody's listening or watching, so... Right? Betsy's nodding her head very knowingly on that score. So we'll just leave it at that. We'll take a quick break. Then we'll get to your calls. We'll get to your emails. And if you've Twittered us yet, does anybody want to be the first one to Twitter a question? Do it. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
On the next Fresh Air, how profit is driving nuclear proliferation. We talk with David Albright, author of the new book Peddling Peril, How the Secret Nuclear Trade Arms America's Enemies. Albright is the founder and president of the Institute for Science and International Security, which investigates and monitors nuclear proliferation. Join us for the next Fresh Air.
Fresh Air begins in 20 minutes. It starts at noon right here on WOSU 820 NPR News. Get the latest information from WOSU the way you want it, daily, biweekly, or monthly. Go to WOSU.org/email and sign up for one of our e-newsletters. And WOSU Public Media and the Women's Fund of Central Ohio present the Keyholder 10 event, featuring Academy Award-winning actress and director Diane Keaton, Wednesday, May 12th at the Ohio Theater. More information is available at womensfundcentralohio.org. 51 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 65. Clear skies tonight, a low of 38 degrees. More sunshine promised for Friday with a high of 65 degrees. And even more sunshine on Saturday, a high right around 65 for Saturday. And then some rain moves in on Sunday. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. Thanks for joining us.
You're no one if you're not on Twitter. And if you aren't there already, you've missed it. If you haven't been bookmarked, retweeted, and blogged, you might as well not have existed. You might as well not have existed. In the old days, it was all about achievements. Collecting all your trophies in a shrine.
In a shrine.
And everybody came across the internet.
Internet.
And suddenly you had to be online.
Welcome back. You're on the air with Ann Fisher. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820. And we're talking about social media, a little bit about Twitter, as we have in the past. And Twitter's a big deal, but I want to encourage you to give us a call or email us at allsides@wosu.org. We have some calls right now. And Joe, we sort of talked about this, but you're saying social networking causes people not to tune each other out, but to tune out society?
Absolutely. There's two sides to every equation.
Of course.
There's good to this. In particular, like with Dave Carroll, you know, holding people more accountable, that's easier to do. My mother still, if she has a beef with the company, she does one of two things. She either calls, but more likely she'll write a letter, snail mail. And, you know, that's definitely the older generation. I'm in the middle there. I'm middle-aged. I use, the computer. I use my cell phone, which is the old-fashioned way of calling you right now instead of Twittering you. But I think that there's definite downfalls to it. I mean, I have a 12-year-old and a 15-year-old, and, you know, they can't go anywhere without headphones in their ears for their iPod or their Zoom, and they go in a store. They're staring at a phone. They got headphones in their ears. Mm-hmm. They're completely unaware of what's going on around them, just like that young girl a while back that walked into a sinkhole. And then
I hadn't heard that.
Oh, yeah, it was on the news. She walked into a hole.
Well, I guess I tuned that out.
There you go. And the mother wanted to, she was thinking about a lawsuit. And I'm thinking, you know, maybe if, and her daughter was texting while doing that. Mm-hmm. Thinking, you know, you can't tune everything else out around you for the newest form of communication. And my computer was busted for about 3 months, just broke down.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you what, it was the best 3 months. It was liberating to not feel like, oh, I got to go check this. Oh, I got to go do that. There's more than our younger generation is seeing, and it's not staring at a screen.
I did notice that on a driving trip one time. We were going through some beautiful place and beautiful area, and there was lots of beautiful scenery, and my kid just could not get his brain out of the iPod and out of the handheld.
It's something. We were driving the same way, you know, and you're looking down, a couple thousand feet into a beautiful valley, and they're staring at screens. And used to, in the old days, and you know, my generation, it was, hey, get your head out of that TV. That was the only screen you could stare at. Now you got TV, you got computer screens, you got handheld games, Nintendo. I mean, I don't get it.
It used to be when we were on trips, they'd say, quit that rat killing back there. I'm going to. Thanks a lot, Joe, for your call.
Exactly.
You know, that's going to be an ongoing issue. But it's like kids are with a lot of stuff that's new to them. And
it is. I mean, it's a challenge in a sense for all of us, because we really, by no means are we saying that we think that everyone should live this hyper-connected life and always be online and be plugged in all the time. The challenge for us is to figure out, how do you navigate this? How do you use these tools in a way that benefits your life? And how do you know, you know, how do you have the discipline to turn them off and not, and also cultivate a life that isn't about being plugged in and is about face-to-face conversations? It's just part of the new sort of skill set that we all need. Because whether we like it or not, these new tools aren't going to go away. We really have to work on how we're going to manage it. And as parents, I have two boys, and, you know, I wrestle with this a lot. And in some ways, I really, you know, I err on the Luddite side as a parent, because I want my kids to have a really vibrant face-to-face offline life. And so we really limit. We limit the amount of screen time they have. And I think it does, as a parent, I think it raises all sorts of new challenges for how you raise a kid in this hyper-connected age.
Yeah. Let's talk a little bit about journalism now, because that's my background. That's Deb's background. And I know, Betsy, you train journalists now in social media. Let's take a typical newspaper like the Columbus mm-hmm. Dispatch. Or just take any old newspaper. Let's not pick on the local one necessarily. But what is the benefit of social media to a newspaper? Just driving the readers back to the newspaper as often as possible?
Well, you know, I think that what newsrooms if they're really savvy, will understand is that this is a great way to listen to what people have to say. So newsrooms are used to, you know, in the mass communications world, we were much more used to talking out, telling you what we thought, you know, and your ability to respond was pretty limited. You could write a letter to the editor and maybe it would get published, but there weren't that many ways as journalists that we could hear what you thought. You might be able to write us an email or, you know, that sort of thing. But today, what newsrooms are recognizing is they're not the only ones talking. that a lot of folks are talking, and they're talking at the same time that the newspaper's talking. And that's what we call the massive communications world. And it's a conversation. And I think for newsrooms, they've got to get less formal. You know, they're not lecturers anymore. The age of the lecturer is over, and they've got to start listening more and having conversations with people. It's fascinating. If you look at the Chicago Tribune, they have a formal Twitter feed where you just they tweet out headlines, mm-hmm. and they have about 26,000 people tuning into that. And then they have an informal feed that they call Colonel Tribune, and he's wearing a newspaper hat, and he looks very funny, and he has conversations with readers. And they have over 800,000 followers. So this is an opt-in world, and people, if given the choice, will opt in if you're more casual and conversational, and you really show that you care about what they think, as well as, you know, you can't just be the guy at the party who's bragging about himself all the time or talking about himself all the time, because people will tune out, I think, from that.
Yeah, there, NPR had some guidelines. I was reading. Scott Simon helped put them together from Weekend Edition, the host from Weekend Edition. And one of the things they said is, you know what, every once in a while, respond to one of the people that's responding or replying to your Twitter, because they're interesting, and we care about what they think. They're our listeners.
And smart businesses are figuring out there's all of these tools that if someone mentions your name in any of these sites, you know it. So you can say, oh, let me respond. Let me, you know, I'm sorry that happened to you, or I'm glad you like our product, or whatever it is that people are saying about you. You know, a friend of mine who's still a journalist is using Facebook, and she's increased the traffic to her columns by a third because she's engaging with people. People are interested, more interested in what she's writing. And I tell journalists, look, selling is not selling out. We sell every time we write a lead. We're trying to get you to read our story. We sell every time we write a, you know, captivating headline. Now we can't just rely on our masthead today to get people, to get audiences for what we write. What we have to do is engage with people in lots of different spaces so that we're letting lots of people know what it is that we're doing and the stories that we're covering. And we really have to be more human. You know, we really have to say, mm-hmm. this is, we are doing this. This is what, you know, we can't just sort of lurk in the background of the meeting. We have to tweet out, we're at the meeting and here's what's going on. Or we have to be on Facebook and having conversations with the people who are reading our work.
I've got a question from Facebook. My first. It's so exciting. It's from Amy. She writes, I have been estranged from my family for years, but recently joined Facebook and found my sister. The casual glimpses into our lives is helping us rediscover each other as individuals and put all the hurts, slights, issues from the past behind us. Wow. That kind of chokes me up a little
bit. It does. That's a powerful story. And it speaks to the power of this, of these channels. It really is fundamentally about allowing opportunities for connection. And that's a good news story. Now, there's bad news stories out there, too, but it's always refreshing to hear, you know, and we hear this a lot. We hear about people. We were doing a training session. A woman stood up and said that she found her son that she had put up for adoption 20 years ago. And so there's a lot of stories about this technology being used to bring people closer together.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, I do think part of it is really understanding how to use this space. I think sometimes people get on and it's overwhelming. But if you can spend some time with it and really figure out how to use it, you can use it and have a lot of good things happen to you as a result. But it's like Betsy said, you have to be smart about what you do and thoughtful and, you know, limit the amount of time that you're doing it and not, you know, try to avoid being on it all the time, that sort of thing.
You have a question from someone via Twitter.
Yeah, there's a question here from Chip Midnight, and he was asking us, did we find South by Southwest to be an experience that a beginner could get a lot out of, or is it more for social media experts? And, you know, that's a really good question. What was apparent to me being there, and this was my first time at the conference, is that it was a very broad audience this way, that's exactly the question. There's a lot of new people trying to come to this and went to South by Southwest to try to understand what's happening in the social media world. The conference was designed for people who really are sort of
experts
and really into the technology. And so it sort of speaks to this larger issue. We're moving from the early adopter stage to the mass adoption stage of this. And there's a real need to help people understand South by Southwest is struggling to serve both of those audiences.
And I would just add, this is a good chance to say, that's why we do our 3-day immersion KIPP camps. Mm-hmm. You know, we're doing one actually April 22nd through the 24th, because it takes more than an hour to understand a revolution. I mean, it really takes more than 3 days to understand a revolution, but at least with 3 full days, you can help walk people through lots of different things. It is not easy to get your arms around this space.
So, I think in 3 days, what I learned was just how big it was. I mean, yeah. I could use another 3 days learning, figuring out how to navigate it better. But first, you need to understand what you're navigating.
Yeah,
I have a lot better idea.
It isn't just about the new tools. It's about the new thinking.
Right.
I mean, that's what people, sometimes people go, oh, let's get on Facebook and or let's get on Twitter. But if you haven't done some thinking about your approaches yet, then you might find it's not that useful.
Let's see. Let's take some calls. Kathy, you're on the air. You want to talk about the permanency of Facebook and that and the issue of privacy were two topics at South by Southwest. What do you have to say, Kathy?
Well, I have a couple of comments, and I'm going to fold some questions into them. So if you could just bear with me for a minute. I think I'm concerned about the permanency of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm leery. I'm really leery. I have not joined Facebook. I don't anticipate joining it. I think when we think about 15-year-olds, well, I guess I think of life as a process, just kind of like, you know, you're writing a text or living a text. Writers don't want their drafts all over the place.
Mm-hmm.
Kids and young adults and adults at different stages, you know, I feel like there's a possibility that who they are is going to be kind of squelched by their fear of sort of being outed as having done something later in life, you know? So can our 15-year-olds be 15-year-olds, be goofy,
mm-hmm.
make foolish decisions, grow from them without some future employer looking back and saying, well, you did this and you didn't, you know? And I don't know. I'm just concerned about that. I think one of the best things about life is that we can take chances. We can be creative, maybe not foolish, you know, totally foolish, but do we want to squelch that? And then I'm really concerned that you can't go in and sort of undo, you know, what you were at 15. So you're 25, you're looking for a job. Let's go in and erase Facebook. And that, I think, is troublesome to me. And then finally, the idea that somebody else, you know, I'm at a party somewhere, I have no idea that somebody, and I'm kind of a reserved person anyhow, as you mm-hmm. might infer from my comments,
mm-hmm.
but, you know, somebody's having a good time, somebody's doing whatever, drinking a beer, their picture is posted by someone of you by on someone else's Facebook. I mean, what about that? Are there any... Like, from my understanding, which I admit is limited, there's very little repercussion you can do. That public activity, that people can take your pictures, they can do what they want, they can publish your photos. So it just makes me feel very concerned and guarded about the whole thing. In the same way that the woman found her son, I think that people who are being stalked, I mean, I think, you know, I think, like you said, there are flip sides.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely.
Do you mm-hmm. anticipate that the permanency of it is something that's going to remain permanent, or will people be able to go in and, you know, revise former postings?
Or could it be its downfall someday? Could everyone agree that we don't want to do this? We don't want it to be permanent, so we'll just eliminate it.
You know, Obama the other day when he was giving advice. Obama the other day when he was giving advice to teenagers said, be careful what you do on Facebook. When someone asked, you know, how would I run for president? So I think that is a really good question.
Yeah, there's a lot of really good points and observations mm-hmm. in these comments, and you know, I almost don't know where to begin because I do agree. I mean, one of the things I think about the fact that there's almost no escaping your past, and for many of us, you know, it was a great relief to go off to college because that was a chance to totally reinvent ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we could leave our friends behind, we could leave our old identities behind, we could start fresh, or we can move to a new city and do the same thing. And now, what does it mean when, you know, your past, your connections, all of those are associated with you? You know, we used to go through stages of life and sort of leave friends behind as we move on. What happens now when the expectation is that you are maintaining all these relationships throughout your life? I think those are some big changes.
Yeah, and it's not even leaving opinions behind. I mean, we change our minds. And so we were working with someone the other day who was on that deep web search I was telling you about. And he said, wow, this is a congressional testimony I gave, you know, in the early or in the late eight or the late 90s, and I'd forgotten I'd even given it. So, I, you know, that would be public, and if you looked hard enough, you would find it. But these days, it comes up very easily. So, yeah, it is much harder to escape what you did when you were younger or what your opinions used to be, and much harder to say, well, my opinions today have changed. And I think they are really good questions. We tell people, and we didn't make this up, there's videos out there about this, but what happens in Vegas stays on Facebook, you know?
Right.
Because today, and on YouTube and on Twitter. And,
right.
And we talk with our students about that and say, these are very public spaces, and you want to have your best, you want to think about this as a professional space in some sense. Because we have students say, oh, no, what I do on Facebook is private, and I have set all of my privacy settings, and we say all four levels, and they'll say yes, because a lot of people think they've set privacy, and they don't know how complicated it is. Mm-hmm. And then we say, okay, so you've set all your privacy settings. How many friends do you have? And they'll say 500. Uh-huh. And we'll say, so what is your expectation of privacy if you have 500 friends? So you just really have to be careful in these spaces.
Thanks a lot, Kathy, for your call.
You're welcome. Thanks for your response.
You bet. Terry, you're on the air. You have some tips for parents just entering the Facebook era.
Yes, I happen to be in my, let's just say, mid-40s, and I am a heavy Facebook user, have over 1,100 friends. And my sister, who lives in Toledo, so I can tell the secret without anybody knowing.
We do post this on the internet.
Right. That's true. She has two teenage daughters, 15 and 16. So she has subscribed to Facebook. She's friends with them. And I explained to her how you can set up a mobile phone notification. So every time her daughters update their Facebook profile with a status update, she gets very passively a text message with what the update is. So she can sort of keep track, and she's concerned and wants to monitor it, but she doesn't want to be seen as overwhelming and overbearing to her daughters. So she just kind of keeps track of her of them by text messages.
Hmm. Okay.
The other thing is I've noticed a couple friends of mine are actually – they're more college age, and they're going through the job search process. And one of them actually changed their last name on Facebook. And when I found out why, it was because potential employers can't find him.
Ha ha.
So I think there will be workarounds to all privacy issues. People will be creative. And I think the last caller, one issue, you know, certainly it is, as people get older, that stuff is going to stay there. But I think one solution is just to delete your account or make your account inactive and create a new account. And okay. I think we'll be seeing more of that.
Betsy?
I think Terry. Your point is well taken, that there are going to be more workarounds and people are going to get savvier. In some ways, we're in this, you know, the Wild West stage of this, and that people don't realize the full implications. I think privacy is going to become the big issue. You're starting to see that now as we start to understand the full implications of what it means for all of us to have such a public life and, you know, such an enduring, as we call it, a digital footprint that is out there. So I think that this is going to be the key issue, and I think you'll see a lot of debate and discussion and most likely more ways for people to manage. You know, it's not for most of us. It's not that we want to be exclusively private. We just want control, better control over what goes public or not.
And they are working on that.
But the reality is, I mean, you know, our bottom line advice is just presume that everything is public. I mean, I don't even trust privacy settings. Mm-hmm. Who knows what systems are going to be hacked? I mean, you just have to presume that this is an extension of yourself, and that you really need to be very careful. We say, think twice and post once anytime you put something online.
Right. Because it is an extension of your public persona. I mean, someone was saying the other day, well, what if I don't want people to know I hunt? And we were saying, don't hunt online. You know, I mean, you have to really be thinking. It's in some sense, it's what we learned with email. Do you remember when email came out mm-hmm. and people finally figured out, oh, if I put something in the email, you can forward it.
It can become a public record.
Exactly. Yeah. It can become a public record. Mm-hmm. Or text messages can become public record. Some of our politicians have found that out the hard way.
Yeah. We've out of time. I hope I'll have you guys back again soon, because as you said at the outset, things change very, very quickly in the social media world.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Deborah Jasper is director of the Kiplinger Program in Public Affairs Journalism at Ohio State University, and also Betsy Hubbard, associate director at the Kiplinger Program. Both of you, thanks again for being with us.
Thanks so much, Ann.
It was great.
And before we sign off, I want to officially invite my listeners again to follow me on Twitter at Ann Fisher at WOSU, at Ann Fisher WOSU, and on Facebook at All Sides with Ann Fisher fan page. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus, and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.
Support for WOSU comes from Ohio Wesleyan University, congratulating its students on receiving the Presidential Award for Higher Education Community Service. Last year, nearly 1,800 Ohio Wesleyan students gave their time and talent to help others. OWU.edu.